Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Now, I'm not sure if I'm telling office secrets out of school, but I got to tell you that a couple of weeks ago, our microwave oven at SciFry HQ broke down. Now, right? Not really a big deal, not big news, except the way it broke down, the way it broke was kind of dangerous. You know, normally when you open up the door, the microwave shuts off, but in this case, opening the door turned on the microwave. So here you found yourself looking, staring into the microwave oven with all these microwaves coming out. And of course, it created a bit of anxiety on the team and prompted some other microwave safety questions. So producer Christy Taylor captured some of those questions and concerns around our office.
I opened the door and it turns on, which is weird, but I didn't really think too much about it, and I just stuck my hand in the microwave while it was microwaving to get my pasta. Then I was sitting at my desk and I'm like, does my hand feel weird?
If it's cooking chicken, is it also cooking my hand if it is on with my hand in it?
But like, what does a microwave do to body parts?
Does it mess with my vision? Will it, like, give me, like, brain cancer? I know that microwaves are safe, and I know this is a little irrational, but, you know, I just want to make sure that this broken one isn't going to, like, you know, kill me.
I stayed away from the kitchen, too, just in case people like you are going to be using it.
How close am I allowed to stand in front of the microwave? Because I like to watch the cheese on my nachos melt.
What is on the door that's protecting us from it? I mean, I see, like, the little meshy pattern. That's all that's needed.
I always wonder if all the microwave food I eat is going to give me cancer the same way everything else is eventually going to give me cancer.
Oh, God, what if it goes on fire?
I've seen insects get microwaved and seem fine. How does that work?
How much actual, is it radiation that we're getting from a microwave?
Obviously, you shouldn't put your pets in there.
I don't have that many questions about it.
I've just assumed it was a completely safe and effective mechanism for heating my pasta.
Yeah, there's that beep. So we had all these questions. And if we have all these questions, I'm sure you've had all these questions about microwave ovens, and even the history of microwaves is really interesting because 2017 marks the 50th anniversary of the first domestically available microwave, the Radar Range, which sold for $497 back in 1967. Namely, because maybe you guessed, the scientist who worked with radar in World War II accidentally discovered that radar waves could be used to cook food. Another case of serendipity. And all these years later, even our geeky science folks in our office, me included, have apprehensions about this essential household device. So we're going to pull in some experts. And here to relate the life and times of the microwave oven and shed more light, visible light on safety, John Dragenberg, Consumer Safety Director for UL, you know, the old Underwriters Laboratory, a safety science company that's been testing microwaves since their advent, and they are based in Northbrook, Illinois. Welcome to Science Friday, John.
It's nice to be with you, Ira.
Thank you. Timothy Jorgensen, an associate professor of radiation medicine at Georgetown University in Washington. He's also the author of Strange Glow, The Story of Radiation, out from Princeton University Press later this year. Welcome to Science Friday, Timothy.
Oh, thank you very much, Ira. Glad to be here.
You're welcome. First question for producer Annie Minoff's sake, is her hand going to be okay after that microwave encounter?
Well, the first thing I would recommend is to get rid of the oven. Maybe John can explain how it could go on when you open the door, because I agree completely.
Throw it away.
the main hazards from microwave ovens come from heating. So you can burn yourself with a microwave oven. So that's the danger. So if the microwave was in fact on and she put her hand in it, she would have felt the heat, and hopefully she would quickly withdraw her hand before she got a burn there. But that's the main hazard with microwave oven. It's the burning.
Mm-hmm. I was saying a few moments ago the microwave has been in our homes for 50 years, Timothy. I know you have written a bit about how we got it in the first place. And I know the history because I've written a little bit about it, but it was a fortuitous accident involving a radar tube and a candy bar, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, so there was this guy, Percy Spencer, up at Raytheon, and he was a whiz with radar. And he was working on developing radar for the government, and one day he was working with an item called a magnetron, which is what actually produces the radar waves. And so the thing was on, and he noticed that a candy bar he had in his pocket was melting. And he attributed it. It must be coming from the microwaves. And so what he did was he took an egg and he aimed the radar magnetron at the egg, and the egg exploded. Then he did something similar with popcorn, and pretty soon he went on to patent that, and it became the microwave oven.
But John, these were not the tiny little ovens that we have today.
Really, the first ones were gigantic ovens. They were as big as a refrigerator, and in fact, to keep the magnetron, which is the main tube that produces the microwave energy, to keep it cool, they had to plumb it with cold water so it would not destroy the magnetron.
So they had them only in big places, maybe steamships in those days, had ocean liners and trains and places you could have a 700-pound box sitting.
Yeah, generally restaurants.
Restaurants.
It was a commercial device that was used only by restaurants or food facilities of one kind or another.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get our listeners in on it because people are going to want to ask questions. 844-724-8255 is our number. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Let's see if we can answer some of the questions that even our staff was asking. And the number one question I know that I get asked all the time about it is, why don't the microwaves go through the glass? Right? If you're standing there, what's keeping them from going through the glass, Timothy?
Well, so the glass has a mesh screen across it with little holes, and those holes are spaced just right so that those waves will not come through, but they'll just bounce around within the oven. So that's a protective screen. So you can see through the holes what's going on in the oven, but the waves are not actually coming out and cooking you. That's how it works.
So how do you test whether there's a leak, John? How do you test whether there's a leak in the microwave door or the oven?
When we test a microwave oven at UL, we do have meters that can measure the radiation that might come out of the door gasket area or even a ventilation opening. And we test every design to make sure that it does meet the standard for leakage of microwave energy. But most microwaves today are very good, and there are very, very few times that we've ever heard of anybody getting burned or hurt from a microwave oven. But consumers have to understand, too, that if you do spill something in your microwave and it runs over the edge of the where the door meets the microwave oven, you've got to clean that up. If it gets to be a crusty mess there, it could allow microwave energy to escape. So keep that door gasket area very clean with a damp rag, and that's the best safety device that you could have is a damp cloth.
Dr. Jorgensen, let's also talk about, you know, we in the vernacular say, I'm going to nuke something in the microwave. There's no nuclear energy or radiation of that type involved, is there?
No. So it is radiation, but radiation comes in an electromagnetic spectrum. So we have everything that from very long wavelength radiation, like AM radio waves that are as long as a football field, all the way down to X-rays, which have wavelengths that are 1/100th of the width of a human hair. And the shorter the wavelength, the higher the energy. So microwaves don't have enough energy to cause biological damage as we think X-rays do. So the whole world of radiation can be divided into two. One is the non-ionizing radiation, which are the microwaves, the radio waves, the cell phone radiation and things like that. And then there's the ionizing radiation, X-rays and gamma waves, who have they have wavelengths so short that they can actually rip electrons off of atoms and cause damage. And it's those things we worry about, the ionizing radiations. The non-ionizing radiations do not damage chemicals.
Right.
They heat them up, but they don't damage them.
Now, I understand that the microwaves heat things by shaking specifically water. They like the water molecule, and they shake the water molecule.
That's right.
What is the best thing to put your food in the microwave to most efficiently allow the microwaves in to get to the food?
Okay, so obviously, paper bowls and things like that, they don't have any water in it. They can allow the waves to get in very easily. If you you obviously can't use metal containers because they'll block the waves. Ceramic will let a large amount of the radiation in, so that's usually not a problem. Anything that doesn't have any moisture in it is a good holding vessel for the food items you want to cook.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the. And that's, I'm sorry. Go ahead, John.
That's very correct. But sometimes now paper plates, if it's reconstituted paper, have little metal filings in them that are not perceived by the eye, and that sometimes causes them to look a little burned when you take them out of the microwave oven. It's something that we hear of ever so often. It's not terribly dangerous, but the fact is a paper plate that has reused paper, which everybody wants to do because that's very environmentally conscious to do that, but you can have that situation.
Yeah.
And also, if you put a nice plate in there that might have a gold trim along the edges of some kind, that is something that would cause some problems, too, because it could heat that gold ring, which is a metal, and it could cause maybe the food to get too hot in certain places.
And you know, people put those takeout food boxes with the little metal handle on them, like the Chinese food in there, and they spark, right? Those little metal parts are kind
of definitely can spark, especially if they touch the side of the chamber, or the cavity, as it's called technically. And the same is true with aluminum foil. You can get away with it a little bit, but the fact is, once it touches the side of the microwave oven, you get gigantic sparks. And we've done some research on that at UL and can tell you that almost any type of aluminum foil could cause a problem inside a microwave oven.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me see if I can get one quick question in from Kansas. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, I've been waiting 30 years to ask this question. In the 1980s, an osteopathic doctor told me that he said, do not use a microwave oven because it heats the food to too high of a temperature. It kills the enzymes, which is why we eat food. Those were his words. What do you say?
Well, you know, quickly, because I got 30 seconds till the break. So if you can get it then, 30 seconds.
Okay. No, the answer is no. the only thing that's going to destroy food nutrition is if it does get too hot, and you can make it too hot by boiling. You can make it too hot in the oven, on the grill, and with the microwave. Don't worry about the microwaves in that regard.
We're gonna stay with this for a few minutes when we come back from the break. So stay with us. We'll be right back and talk more a bit about microwaves.
On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're wrapping up a little segment about microwaves, microwave ovens with John Dregenberg and Timothy Jorgensen. John, at UL, where you are, I understand that you test the microwaves with a baked potato. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the many tests we do on a microwave oven. The leading cause of fires inside a microwave oven is popcorn and potatoes. And we saw that there was a lot of incidents of fires inside of microwave ovens. And when we did the research on it, we found that it was the popcorn and the potatoes. And we thought, what kind of a test could we develop that would help that problem? We came up with what we call the cavity fire containment test. And the way we do it is we put potatoes inside a microwave oven on the turntable, a number of potatoes, and we heat them until they're cooked. We heat them until they turn get very dry, they turn black, and ultimately little sparks appear across the peel and they burst into flame. And then you've got a flaming merry-go-round inside. But before we do all of that, we cover the microwave oven with a material called cheesecloth, which is our fire indicator. If that fire inside the microwave oven gets to the cheesecloth, it's a failure. If it doesn't, it's okay. It doesn't sound too okay when you know that you've ruined your microwave oven, but the reality is it saves your house and it saves your family from a possible terrible disaster. And that's simply because very often we're in such a hurry, we push all the wrong buttons on the microwave oven and then run away from it. Nobody wants to sit there and watch the food cook.
Right.
And we find that people, you know, as hard as they try, they might set it for 3 hours or some huge amount of time and leave the potatoes or whatever's in there alone, and then you can get a fire. So we just want it to be contained so it doesn't spread to the bread wrappers or the paper towels on your kitchen counter.
Last question, Dr. Jorgensen. Why are people so fearful of the microwave?
Well, I think it's largely because you can't see it, you can't smell it, you know it's there, you see it before your eyes what it's doing to food, and it kind of mystifies people, you know. And the other thing, it's a man-made type of radiation, and people tend to be more worried about man-made types of radiation rather than cosmic radiation from space or radon from the soil. For some reason, people are more worried about the radiations that we make than the radiations that we encounter in the environment, I think.
All right. We could talk about this for quite a while because there's so much fun you can do with a microwave. But just be safe when you do that stuff. John Dregenberg, Consumer Safety Director for UL, based in Northbrook, Illinois. Timothy Jorgensen, Associate Professor of Radiation Medicine at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. Have a great weekend. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Ira.
It's our pleasure.
And now we're going to move on to something totally different. We're going to talk about the ocean. With each splash of a wave in the ocean makes a froth of bubbles. But what happens next is complicated. With each of these bubbles, when they pop, stuff from the ocean's surface can be released as particles into the air. And some of these particles can even get swept up into the upper atmosphere. Yeah, where they can interact with other chemicals, and potentially they can travel for thousands of miles. My next guest studies the chemistry of these aerosols and how they form and interact with the environment. She's written about plankton and bacteria in the aerosol process, and then she's published her work this week in the journal Chem. Vicky Grassian is co-director of the Center for Aerosol Impacts on Climate and the Environment, professor also at University at San Diego, UC San Diego. She joins me from the campus there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're quite welcome. So let's talk about the particles. What kinds of particles are we talking about that get thrown up into the air?
So mainly we're talking about sea spray aerosol. So these are aerosols produced from wave action, from these bursting bubbles, as you just mentioned a moment ago. And they actually consist of a wide range of different compositions and different sizes. So one of the things that we wanted to do in this paper that just came out this week in the journal Chem was look at in detail at the molecules coming out of the water within these particles and tried to say something about how that changed during the course of a phytoplankton bloom. And so in general, I just want to add that what gets out of the ocean are things like salts. Typically, that's what people think about, but also organic compounds and biological components, even whole bacteria.
Tell us what happens when the bubble, are we talking about the waves crashing on the shore, or are we talking about foam out in the ocean? What kind of bubbles are we talking about here?
In this study, we basically looked at the when we had waves and we have bubble bursting during that wave process, and we captured the aerosols and looked at them individually to see what they were made up as. And what was unique about this experiment is that we did this in an ocean atmosphere facility where we can cut off and close off all other influences and just look at that sea spray forming mainly from that wave action.
So we brought them inside into a big tank and created the waves and watched the bubbles, created the foam, watched the bubbles burst. And how does a bubble burst? I mean, you in slow motion, if you watch a bubble in your wave action, what do you see happening?
So the bubble bursting process is something that I've learned quite a lot about from my physical oceanography friends here at the University of California, San Diego. And basically what you have is you have the bubble burst so that the film bursts, and then that forms film drops. And then subsequent to that, you get the jet drops from underneath. And so whether you get the film rupture, and that forms very small particles, which have a lot of organic compounds associated with them, versus the jet drops, which tend to form the larger particles, although we're questioning sort of that understanding right now within our center as well. But that's what we're interested in looking at, is the different mechanisms and what molecules come out of the water because of these different mechanisms.
You got to tell me what a jet drop is. It's not a 747 hitting anything, right?
It's basically that's a good point. So basically, when you have the film rupture, There's some energy left over. And so what you end up getting is from the bottom of that drop, some additional, if you were to look at that with a microscope, you'd see another small droplet of water coming out of the ocean from the middle after that bubble bursting process from the top. So the film drops versus the jet drops. And one is bigger than the other. And so that's what we're looking at is the differences in the composition of each of these, because how they how they get out there is very, very different.
Yeah, and so once the stuff, once you have your film drop and your jet drop, now we have droplets all through the air, where do they go?
So these aerosols get into the air, and then they, from their formation, they go undergo long-range transport, and so then they start interacting with gases and other particles in the atmosphere. And so as they move out from the ocean, they can really change in terms of their composition, in terms of their what they're associated with, whether they're associated with other particles that were in the atmosphere from other sources as well.
Mm-hmm. So when all these particles are traveling, you've now got the particles in the air, and you, if you capture them in your lab and you look at them under the microscope, what do you see there?
So that's what this study focuses on, is basically us capturing, and then we capture them onto a substrate. So we just put them on a piece of glass, a glass slide, if you will, and then we look at them in great detail in terms of their composition using a variety of different state-of-the-art techniques in order to get that information about their composition. So we use a lot of what we call spectroscopy in our lab, or mass spectrometry, in order to see what the composition of each of these individual particles are, what they're made up of.
Mm-hmm. And what are they made? What do you see?
So very interestingly, we see things like fatty acids, we see sugars, we see simple sugars like glucose, we see more complex sugars like what we call polysaccharides. So we see a wide range of different types of compounds coming out of the ocean. They also, these particles can contain both salts, so sodium chloride, plus these organic compounds. And so what we were able to really do in our paper was look at individual particles and say something about their individual compositions.
Wow. I mean, it's fascinated by this. First, you've described two ways of the bubble. When the bubble bursts, I had no idea there's a compound action going off in the membrane and then the jet at the bottom. And then once you get these particles in the air, now I understand from reading stuff that for storms, for example, for terrain, you need to have nuclei, little bits of stuff. Could the stuff coming out of the ocean form the nuclei that create some of the showers or thunderstorms or something like that?
So that's right. And so these particles can nucleate clouds. They can nucleate ice crystals in the atmosphere. And so, yes, very much so. They can be part of how we think about precipitation and cloud formation. And so that's a big component of what our center studies. And so what we provide is information on what these particles are made of, and then others provide information on how can they nucleate a cloud, how can they nucleate ice crystals.
Mm-hmm. So you study a lot of particles. Do you study dust, just plain dust, too, in the air?
You know, I'm the dust queen. And what I mean,
I'm glad you said it and not me, because I'd get in trouble if I said that. Is that what they call you around the office, the lab, the dust queen?
I've been called the dust queen, and the reason why is that a lot of my work has also focused on mineral dust and trying to understand mineral dust in the atmosphere. And mineral dust comes from a different source; It comes from desert regions, and they too can undergo long-range transport, these dust particles. And very similar to sea spray, each individual particle is a bit different. And so what we do is we study the composition of these particles, we study how they react in the atmosphere, and we study how they can nucleate clouds.
Hmm. So can dust come, thinking about the water, can there be dust in the water too? You said that they're from dry places, but could you have dust being spread by the waves and the bubbles bursting?
Oh, so now you're asking sort of another interesting question, because what we know is that mineral dust from desert regions undergo long-range transport, and some of it deposits into the oceans. And that's actually an important process, because sometimes the iron in the dust particles is a nutrient for ocean life under certain circumstances. That's often, that nutrient is limited. And so we know the dust goes into the ocean, and then you're asking sort of the next question, does it come back out of the ocean? And so that's something that we're actually looking at in our center.
Tell me about the particles themselves. How large are they, ranging in size?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So for the sea spray, I'll focus on that because that's what we started talking about. The particles are anywhere from, and I'll use my speak for a moment, and then I'll put it in a perspective.
Please.
They go from 30 nanometers, and a nanometer is 1 times 10 to the minus 9 meters, to about 10 microns, or 10 micrometers, where micrometers 1 times 10 to the minus 6 meters. And so let's put it in a different perspective. So if I think about a single hair, okay, so these particles can be anywhere from 10 to 1,000 times smaller than a single width of a hair.
Wow. Well, you've set off my break meter. I have to remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Dr. Vicky Grassian, co-director of the Center for Aerosol Impacts on Climate and the Environment. And no wonder, you have a long name. You study a lot of things like that. So how much of these particles, I'm thinking now about pollution, how much of the particles that get spread around the world are natural, and how much are they man-made, person-made, people-made particles?
So that's a great question, because, and that's a lot about what we think about as well, because we really want to understand natural sources of aerosols, what their input into the atmosphere is, and then we can better understand what the influence of pollution particles may be, particles from anthropogenic sources. So from a mass perspective, if we were to weigh all the particles, many of the particles in the atmosphere are from sea spray and from mineral dust, so from dust storms and from wave action. But when we look at the number of particles, so if we look at it a little bit differently, instead of just weighing it, we look at the number, a lot of the smaller particles are actually anthropogenic particles, pollution particles, as you just mentioned a moment ago. And so it depends on the size. It depends on whether we're looking at number of particles or mass of particles. Well, but both are very important in the atmosphere. Both play a role in the atmosphere, I should say.
How are you seeing nanoparticles? Because they're ubiquitous. These man-made nanoparticles, are you seeing them being spread around in the air by the waves or the dust?
So I just told you a moment ago that some of the particles coming out of the ocean are nanoparticles.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we actually, so they're naturally occurring nanoparticles.
Natural ones.
That's right.
Not that we engineer those particles, those kinds I'm speaking of.
Yes, and so then there's a whole other set of particles, engineered nanoparticles. And so, yeah, you can see some of these, some of the engineered nanoparticles can make it in the air. There's been some studies to try to quantify that, but I think that's something we're still interested in understanding and interested in knowing. And so these things would be like, you know, titanium dioxide nanoparticles or zinc oxide
nanoparticles.
Stuff
from makeup and things like that.
Makeup, sunscreen.
Right.
Just think about sunscreen for a minute.
Yeah.
Okay. You put it on and then you go into the water, it comes off. Then you come back and put it on again. So where did it go?
Oh, what a question. That's a very good question. it's still with us, obviously, right? It's getting washed off in the ocean, and then maybe the waves are going to throw it back up in the air. Do people think enough about this, do you think, paying up attention to this stuff?
You know, I think we could think more about it because there are consequences to everything we do. And so I really do feel like sometimes we don't think about the next step. Yeah. So I put this on, I go in the water, it comes off. Okay, you know, the ocean is large. Do you think it just goes away, far away, or, you know, Does it stay? What is it made of? Is it at the surface of the ocean? Can it come back out into the air? I think that's those are questions that are really important to think about and to ask.
I'm very glad that you brought that up because it's always something good to think about. Leave everybody with something good to think about. Thank you, Dr. Grassian.
Thank you.
And have a happy Mother's Day if you are. Vicky Grassian, co-director of the Center for Aerosol Impacts on Climate and the Environment in San Diego. We're going to take a break and we're going to start talking. We have more to think about, especially about how marijuana, that's right, how marijuana could make old brains sharper. Yes, you heard me right. We'll talk about it after the break. Stay with us. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI. Getting ready to finish up with the rest of the program. And I thought I'd read some tweets that came in about our last segment. Let's read Pomeroy says, remember, keep door area clean with a damp cloth. Avoid the fiery merry-go-round. And people really were surprised. I think this was the most interesting comment we got about using, you know, that baked potatoes. And it's a question of, is this a new meme? Instead of a dumpster fire, we have a microwave potato fire. So people are talking about that. So let's move on to some other interesting stuff, because I think I have a story here that's going to be as interesting, at least, about the fire in the microwave. And that is about marijuana, a new marijuana study that shows that in older people, marijuana, a study in mice, at least, in older mice, showed that when given to the mice, they had a sharper memories by the end of the study. And in fact, they were on par with younger mice who hadn't had any exposure to THC at all. And they published the research in the journal Nature Medicine last week. So what does this mean for those of us with aging human brains? And how do we continue research with marijuana, which is, as you know, classified as a Schedule I drug? And that means federal regulations limit its use in actually conducting research on marijuana. My next guest, I think, has some insights on that. Stacey Gruber is director of the Marijuana Investigations for Neuroscientific Discovery and the Cognitive and Clinical Neuroimaging Core Programs at McLean Hospital. And she's associate professor of psychiatry at Harvard and Cambridge. Welcome to Science Friday.
Well, thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
So this was done in mice, right? So let's we know how hard that is to move that into people studies.
Right.
So are you saying we should start prescribing pot to everyone who's starting to lose their car keys? Not yet, I'll bet.
Well, that would certainly be an interesting headline, wouldn't it?
Yes.
I think people would be very interested in hearing that. So, you know, I think these types of preclinical or animal studies are always extraordinarily interesting and always very helpful in terms of areas like this where we absolutely positively need more research. You know, these studies of mice, and in this case, you know, three different groups of mice, certainly give us some really interesting ideas about what might be happening. And it actually dovetails pretty nicely with what we see in recreational human marijuana users, in addition to more recent work in medical marijuana patients. So it's interesting.
These were not, you know, in studies sometimes they give massive doses of things to lab animals, but this was not a massive dose. Give us a thumbnail of what happened here.
So in this study, there were basically three groups of mice, and they had young mice that they term young because they're 2 months old, mature mice that are a whopping 12 months old, and old mice, which are, I guess, mice that are about 18 months old. And they basically fit, you know, half the animals in each group are what we call vehicle or control, and the other half are given THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, the main psychoactive constituent of the plant, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they did this using sort of a subcutaneous pump method. So it's not like they're, you know, somebody said to me, well, are they smoking little tiny joints? No, they're not. They're not inhaling it. So it's low dose that's administered sort of subcutaneously under the skin. And what they did was they tested the animals first and determined that, in fact, sort of consistent with what we know about aging, young mice not exposed to THC outperformed the mature and the old mice because, in fact, we get a little bit worse with regard to cognitive tasks as we get older. It's very sad, but it's true.
Mm. What did you say?
What was that? Say it again.
Yeah.
There are things we can do, but that's generally the sort of pattern that things tend to follow. Interestingly, the young mice, after being exposed to THC for 28 days, performed significantly worse than the mature or old mice, who actually performed better than the young mice. So a little bit of THC to the young mice made them perform significantly worse. That is, they looked like old mice who hadn't been treated, while the mature and old mice who were treated with THC looked like the young, untreated mice. Hmm. Now, that's very interesting and very similar to what we see in what we call early onset exposed individuals who use marijuana or cannabis at an early age, sort of in our studies prior to the age of 16. Those folks tend to look worse than individuals who began using later. That's because the brain is still absolutely positively immature. It's what we call a period of neurodevelopmental immaturity. It's vulnerable. So exposure during this early period really renders them less able to do these tasks relative to the mature and older mice. The really interesting take-home, though, is what's happening in the mature and old mice who are doing better than the young mice after being given a little THC. And that's something that we're starting to see emerge from at least our ongoing longitudinal study of patients certified for medical marijuana use who look as if they get better on cognitive tasks after only 3 months. We follow them for 2 years, but the first set of data comes after only 3 months. They look like they're performing better. That's very interesting.
Well, does it make a difference that the rats were given, as you say, pure investigational THC? It comes from a lab, absolutely pure, as opposed to people who might buy marijuana on the street.
So a good question that really speaks to what is it that they're being exposed to. And this is, again, yeah, purified THC. Very different from what folks on the street, so to speak, recreational users might be getting. But I will say, while there's other cannabinoids present in recreational cannabis, we've seen the levels of THC, that is the potency of products, increase pretty sharply over the last two decades. And that's also important. It's certainly something to keep in mind as we think about the role of THC and other cannabinoids. But, you know, in the human subject studies of the medical marijuana patients, those folks are on products that are high in THC, but we also have folks who are, you know, using products high in cannabidiol, a main non-psychoactive or non-intoxicating constituent. So it's a good question. It may be that a little bit of THC helps sort of upregulate the endocannabinoid system in these aging animals. That's a real possibility.
Is it difficult to investigate marijuana and THC because of the regulatory landscape, the classification that it's in?
Well, it's certainly not the easiest area of investigation to embark upon, that's for sure. The very best thing to do with studies like this is to replicate clinical trials in human subjects. And in fact, currently, there's only really one source from which you can obtain product to administer to human subjects. And we certainly wouldn't ever be in a position to be able to administer products like that to, let's say, our youngest consumers, our adolescents. That's probably not going to happen for all sorts of ethical reasons. But yes, it's an area that's difficult given the current restrictions. We aren't able to use products that patients and consumers are actually using, you know, from dispensaries or their local dealer. We can't assess the impact of those products, which is a real limitation.
So there's good news and bad news about the study.
Good news and bad news. But yeah, I mean, you know, I think this is certainly the kind of thing that absolutely demands more research. And, you know, chronic low-dose treatment with THC or perhaps other cannabinoids may, I think the authors say, be a strategy to help slow down or reverse potential age-related deficits. We'll have to see how that plays out in humans, but it's certainly promising. And again, I wasn't necessarily expecting what we've seen in our first studies of medical marijuana patients. Very exciting.
Could it be another reason to have medical marijuana for prescribing it?
Yeah, you know, there's so many different indications, and there's always the caveat in many states, you know, you can use it for this indication, this indication, or anything your doctor feels is necessary. So, you know, to improve or increase cognitive performance, typically what we see in the THC-related literature or studies of recreational marijuana really have been reports that THC is detrimental to the brain. But again, mostly those studies focus on individuals who are young.
Yeah.
We don't necessarily know about the impact on older folks. And when you're beyond the level or beyond the period of vulnerability, could it potentially be facilitative? Mm. We don't know.
We'll have you back, Dr. Gruber.
Sure, happy to come back.
Stacey Gruber, Marijuana Investigations for Neuroscientific Discovery Program at McLean Hospital and Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard. Can you guess what this next sound is?
Yeah.
No, it's not what you think it is, my friend. That's a young New Zealand sea lion pup, also known as Hooker sea lion, and it's one of the rarest of all sea lion pups. It lives in New Zealand, of course, and it's just 15 of them were born on the mainland last year. The species was hunted to extinction from the New Zealand mainland, but it's been making a comeback in recent years, and that's the topic of our latest macroscope video. Video producer Chelsea Fisk went to New Zealand to capture the sound of those pups and their parents to see what it takes to help that group of sea lions bounce back. Welcome to Science Friday, Chelsea.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What? That was a strange sound. I never expected that to be a sea lion pup.
Yeah, I noticed a lot of people online were saying that they basically are just burping. So that was a new take I hadn't heard before. But it's very cute in person, I assure you.
Yeah, I was ready to say, excuse me, you know, thinking people thought I was doing it. Now, there was a large population of sea lions that once lived in the mainland in New Zealand at one time.
Yes, that's correct. They used to be found all over on the coast of mainland New Zealand. And then hundreds of years ago, they were hunted to extinction. The subspecies that was on the mainland was hunted to extinction, leaving only the subspecies remaining on the subantarctic islands, so like the Auckland Islands. That was hundreds of years ago. And then not until 1993 was there one female sea lion who they affectionately call Mum, who swam up from the subantarctics, and a local farmer actually found her and a pup back in 1993, and that was the first pup to be born on mainland New Zealand in probably over 200 years. And now all of the pups that are being born on the mainland now pretty much all descend from this one female. So it was pretty remarkable. And it was pretty out of the blue, too. No known reason. She just kind of decided, you know, I want to look for greener pastures.
Yeah.
So.
Wanderlust there. Are they all in one spot? Are they hemmed in? Are they conserved? Or what happened? I'm trying to get a visual picture of where they're sitting or lying around.
Sure. So as far as the Auckland Islands, you know, if you see visuals, they look it's definitely more densely populated there. As far as the New Zealand mainland, there are only maybe 200 or so sea lions that are considered residents of the mainland at this point. You know, there are some visitors that come up from the Auckland Islands, but They're not densely packed. If you see, you know, you're lucky if you might see a couple together on a beach. But typically, you know, especially with these new mums, they're on their own with their pups.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Chelsea Fisk, who went to New Zealand to create our latest macroscope video. Let's hear what that, for people tuning in, let's hear what that pup sounds like again. Now that wasn't me. It wasn't me. Do I understand this correctly? That you actually discovered a pup yourself?
Yes. We were very fortunate. I was with my husband Brandon, and the Department of Conservation there was very generous, especially with their one, basically sea lion whisperer, this ranger Jim, who you'll see in the video, and he had kind of shown us the ropes, how to identify where sea lions have been. And so Brandon and I were on a beach one day just sort of getting some B-roll, and we were heading back to our car, so climbing up these dunes and through a brush area. And I heard exactly what you just played, a tiny little bark. And, you know, we knew enough to know that that was a pup. So we looked around, saw an area that had been kind of flattened, because these are huge creatures, so they tend to flatten any brush that they sort of move over. Mm. And so we crawled under this bush, and there was a little newborn pup, probably no more than a week old, under the bush. So it was very exciting, especially because, as you mentioned, there were only 15 born on the mainland this year. And what the New Zealand Sea Lion Trust does is they typically, and we had found this out beforehand, that they anyone who finds a sea lion pup is usually granted the rights to naming that sea lion pup. And so we did find out that that was a male sea lion pup, and he's also featured in the video. But we are open to suggestions as far as names. We have not chosen a name yet. Typically, they like to do names that are related to Maori culture or science, wildlife, New Zealand, you know, trying to avoid the fluffies and princesses and things of that nature. So far, open to ideas.
So you're welcoming our listeners to suggest names.
Yes, I would love to get some suggestions.
Okay.
I was never very creative with naming my stuffed animals, so this is sort of a big task.
Yeah, a lot of Beanie Babies. So if you want to suggest a name, we're going to set this up here for people who are listening. They really want to suggest a name, and you say we want it to be related to New Zealand or Maori or science or wildlife, none of those poofy names that people come up with. You can send it. Tweet us. Tweet us your name for the pup at SciFry, the normal tweet address, at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Tweet us your suggested name for this New Zealand pup. And we will. You'll judge it. You'll judge it yourself, Chelsea.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully, you know, it's ultimately up to this New Zealand Sea Lion Trust. So they will have final veto power. But I will cull through the suggestions and offer them my favorites.
How is the population doing now?
So the population, it's interesting, actually. The population on the Auckland Islands, which has historically been more robust, is actually on a decline. And whether that's due to, there's a problem with bycatch with fisheries, and also, that population down there is actually having to go much further to forage for their food. So whatever the case may be, that population is decreasing, and so it makes it especially important that the mainland population is steadily on the rise. So mm-hmm. Okay. 15 pups born this year, which is like a record. So
that's great.
We're
to hear.
Hoping for more. Yeah.
Well, we'll wait to see what our listeners come up with. Hopefully better name than I can suggest or get away with. Chelsea Fisk is a video producer. You can see her latest macroscope video up there on our website at sciencefriday.com/sealion. And that's about all the time we have for this week. And if you haven't heard the news, SciFry has just launched a new audio documentary podcast called Undiscovered. The first episode is up this week. You can subscribe to Undiscovered on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast player, or go to undiscoveredpodcast.org. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to the City University of New York. Have a great and safe Mother's Day. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.